under the spell of a dangerous man.
I think the average person, when asked to commit murder, would not do it.
A long-term debt must be repaid in blood.
Fred says, well, I need you to do me a favor. You need the killer for me.
An unhappy housewife is brainwashed to murder.
She was on the ground begging for her life. I'm sure she was about as scared as one could be.
And a child is sacrificed for a twisted love.
It was a nightmare, and you hoped you'd wake up, but the nightmare was always there.
These women became easy prey for a powerful man, turning deadly under his control. Sometimes the strangest things get into a woman's head.
She simply wasn't considering the consequences.
She surrenders to passion and to faith.
Brian explained it would be sort of a merciful thing to do.
There is no turning back.
He needed somebody else to do this, to put her out of her misery.
It's a real enigma that someone so normal could commit such an act.
It's 1990 in Colorado Springs. Jennifer Reale is wishing she never married her soldier husband, Ben. He's strict, controlling, judgmental.
Are you even using that gym membership I got you?
Yeah, why?
Your ass looks like Jell-O.
What do you expect after you've had two kids?
Her husband was emotionally abusive, always denigrating what she was doing. She never could do anything good enough, well enough, for him.
I've been going to the gym twice a week.
It's not showing.
She was not living the life that she had intended for herself. She had sacrificed her dreams and had become this army wife.
Give me those.
They're not done.
I don't care.
She felt trapped. And she was not living up to her potential, and I think that created a huge frustration within her.
Jennifer's misery will soon have company.
Hi, you mind if I join you?
His name is Brian Hood, a dashing 30-something. With a sad story of his own. His wife, Diane, has an immune disease called lupus. She needs constant care.
He was very disappointed that his wife had lupus. She wasn't the same person that he married.
I sell life insurance.
Jennifer and Brian hit it off.
Brian Hood lit a spark in Jennifer's life that she hadn't felt for a long time.
That spark erupts a month later when Jennifer is home alone. Brian makes a house call to sell her insurance, but ends up with a better deal.
No, you're right.
Jennifer is torn between pent-up passion and family responsibilities. She has two children who need her.
I hate to ask, but it's an iron I can borrow.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh.
But she has her own needs, too.
The first time Jennifer and Brian had intimate relations in her home, Jennifer was swept away. There was no returning.
The couple give in to their passion in the laundry room. For the first time in a long while, Jennifer Reale feels the warmth of a loving man.
Sexual arousal, affection, excitement. And he praised her. He lavished her with compliments. And in doing so, criticized her husband.
This would be no ordinary affair. According to Brian, it was sanctioned by God.
We're not one in the eyes of God.
What Jennifer didn't realize is that Brian was not only as dominating as her husband, but worse.
In the coming months, Brian will use religion to plant ideas in Jennifer's mind.
Thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, and whosoever shall let flee with no man is so righteous. Or righteous.
He presented a picture of them being able to live happily ever after with their collective five children if both of their spouses were removed from the picture.
Thou shalt not commit adultery.
To Jennifer, it's an attractive idea. But there's one thing in the way. Brian's sick wife, Diane.
It would be so much easier for him if his wife simply died.
Brian suggests a mercy killing.
Right life, wrong woman.
Part of the way that he convinced her was to use these Bible passages to convince her that it was God's will that Diane should die and then that Jenny should relieve her of her suffering.
Jennifer is being asked to murder. Somehow, in her mind, she's starting to feel it's the right thing to do. For the victim, for her new lover, and for God.
Right life, wrong woman.
That's my first experience with anybody using the Bible to manipulate somebody to do a cold-blooded murder. Especially when the Bible says you shall not kill.
Soon, Jennifer will defy the Bible and her instincts. Disillusioned housewife Jennifer Reale is having a steamy affair with insurance salesman Brian Hood. But they're plotting more than illicit liaisons.
All the medication is doing is just prolonging her suffering. I can't stand being around her any longer. I think the best thing for all of us would be if she would just die.
Brian is convincing his lover that God wants to take his sick wife, and Jennifer should do the taking.
Brian Hood manipulated Jennifer Reale into doing this by using biblical phrases, trying to convince her that it was okay to kill for the purpose of putting Diane out of her misery, and that if she repented afterwards, she would be fine.
It's simply putting a woman out of her misery. It's what God wants.
She, I believe, had been beaten down by her husband and then by Brian Hood to the point where she probably didn't have control of her own volition. She felt under tremendous pressure, and just wanted to get whatever was going to happen over with.
Eventually, Jennifer surrendered to the plan that Brian had developed.
The plan is for Jennifer to jump Diane Hood when she leaves a community center meeting. Brian wants it to look like a robbery gone wrong.
You will then run at her and attempt to snatch her back. When she resists, you will shoot her twice. There's got to be two shots. She's got to be dead.
She changed into army fatigues, some of which belonged to her husband, some of which she had purchased, and a ski mask. And she waited till 8:30 till the meeting let out.
I'm almost noble. What's your secret? Oh. Take it, it's yours! I've been shot!
She was on the ground begging for her life. I'm sure she was about as scared as one could be. Jennifer stood directly over her, cocked the single action 45 automatic, and fired the second round, subsequently killing her.
She shot her twice because she had been told you must shoot twice to make sure that Diane was dead.
Snaps Jennifer back to reality.
The next morning, she woke up and realized what she'd done. She was horrified by what had happened. And she's told us that it was like awakening from a deep sleep.
And it was very soon after that Jennifer confessed to the crime in full.
Now, do you want to tell me what happened?
Jennifer tries to explain why she took an innocent life. No one in the family can believe it.
I was very surprised when I learned what Jenny had done, because it was so far out of character. When I learned about the coercive manner in which Brian dealt with her, it began to make sense. And when I learned that she had confessed to her horror that she had done it, that made sense to me. That's who I thought she was.
Jennifer's testimony helps convict Brian Hood. He claims innocence, but is found guilty of criminal solicitation and murder conspiracy. He's sentenced to 37 years. Jennifer is found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life. Her father will spend the next 20 years trying to understand.
I have between 13 and 14 feet of bookshelf, and I've read every one of them. Every kind of psychology you can think of. I just needed to learn how this could have happened.
His conclusion? Persuasion can be a murder weapon.
Coercive persuasion. And a great many salespeople avail themselves of this method. And frequently they are, like Brian was, a psychology major in college.
I think Jennifer Reale, had she never met Brian Hood, probably would never have killed anybody.
Thank you. at an exclusive school in an upscale suburb of Kansas City. A young student is about to leave early.
He was just a very sweet-looking child that was very easy to be around.
But this is no ordinary boy.
Robert Greenlee's, the father of the boy, was said to be one of the 10 largest shareholders of General Motors.
And this is no ordinary woman.
Hi, Bobby.
Bonnie Hetty didn't seem to have a moral compass.
6-year-old Bobby Greenlee is not going home. Ever.
People didn't trust ever quite as much after that. And I'm sure that they locked their doors. I know my family did.
It's 1953, and post-war America is booming. As for Bonnie Hetty, she's turning tricks for $20 a time in her attic when she's not drinking.
She serviced 150 men over 2 or 3 years. And all was going well until she met a man named Carl Austin Hall.
Bonnie has one failed marriage behind her. But Carl, 10 years younger, looks like a real catch.
Oh, is that all you come in here for, my money?
No.
Bonnie was Carl in female form, and Carl was Bonnie in male form.
Well, then.
Not all.
With a lot in common, they click from the first day.
They both came from money. They both squandered it. They both became alcoholics, which was a huge part of their life.
Need more liquor, baby doll?
Yeah, will you get me some cigarettes?
And of all Bonnie's tricks,
if you're a good girl,
Carl is the only one who wants to stay.
When Carl Austin Hall turned out to be the man who really warmed up to her after meeting, within 2 or 3 days, he moved in with her.
Author John Hedenry says Bonnie is easy prey for a manipulating man.
He sizes her up instantly as, you know, somebody who's not going to give him a lot of trouble, who's pliable, who's a drunk, and who will do what he wants her to do.
Carl once had a rich inheritance and spent it all. Mm. Now he has a plan to take someone else's family fortune. 6-year-old Bobby Greenlee's will be Carl's new meal ticket.
Greenlee's family owned Cadillac distributorships in Kansas and all through the Southwest. Robert Greenlee's was said to be one of the 10 largest shareholders of General Motors.
Ready to hit the road?
Yes, sir.
Great. You can drive today, okay?
Little Bobby means everything to his aging father.
Now give me a kiss.
A lot of people were quite aware of the fact that Mr. Greenlee was quite old when Bobby was born and that Bobby was sort of the apple of his eye.
Pat Litzinich went to school with Bobby Greenlee in the 50s. It was an innocent time.
Kansas City was an easy town in which to be a child. You felt totally safe. You could ride your bike anywhere, take the streetcar or the bus. People didn't lock their doors.
That innocence will let Carl and Bonnie
what am I
make
missing?
A killing.
$1 million is too much for one man to carry.
So how much?
$600,000. in 10s and 20s.
He wants to hold little Bobby for ransom, but he needs a woman to make the kidnap.
Okay, I'll do it.
You'll do it?
I'll do it.
Bonnie falls for it. It will be a brazen kidnapping in broad daylight. At Bobby's school, the French Institute of Notre Dame.
Bonnie Brown Hetty came to the front door and told the nuns that Mrs. Greenlees had suffered a heart attack on the plaza and that she wanted to see Bobby and that she was his aunt and he was to go with her.
Bonnie is in luck. The principal, who may have challenged her story, is unavailable that morning.
The woman was neither the principal nor the sub-principal, but a humble nun who spoke very poor English. After she heard the story that Bobby's mother had had a heart attack, she, of course, believed it.
In the well-mannered world of little Bobby Greenlees, even a stranger is obeyed.
Well, he didn't recognize the aunt, but he didn't show that he didn't recognize her. He just put his hand in her hand and went with her.
Bobby's classmates will never see him again.
Now we've got little Bobby.
Virginia Greenlees and her husband, Robert, have shocking news.
Is he all right?
Their six-year-old only son has been abducted from school. The kidnappers demand $600,000 for his freedom. At that time, the biggest ransom in U.S. history.
Please, just want you to know that we'll do anything, whatever it takes.
Good. Good. Thank you, Mr. Green.
Carl
Thank
Hall
you.
And Bonnie Hetty have chosen the perfect target. The rich parents are ready to deal.
We just want our boy back. Please don't hurt her.
Robert Greenlees and his wife were willing to give $600,000, the equivalent of $10 million in today's money, to this kidnapper, whoever he was. And they would go along with everything. They did not want the police to get involved in the least.
The Greenleases believe their money will save their only son. But Bonnie and Carl won't be keeping their side of the bargain.
I don't think my dog will ever be as big as your boxer.
Really? Well, how big are his paws? Because, you know, you can tell how big a dog is going to get by the size of its paws.
After driving to a clearing with Bonnie's dog as comfort for little Bobby, it's time for part two of the plan.
Where are you going?
I'm just going to take Chloe for a walk. You stay here with Carl, okay?
Seems so strange to me that somebody that could care enough to have a dog with them and obviously care for a dog could do something as heinous as murdering this little boy.
Carl thinks Bobby will give them away if he's returned alive.
Come on, Chloe, let's go for a walk. You stay here with Carl, okay?
Bobby fought back rather vigorously. And Hall, in frustration, threw the rope away and reached for a .38 revolver. And he threw Bobby down into the floorboard of the car and held him there with his hand, and he fired once. And he missed. The bullet went through the floorboard. Hall punched him and knocked out three teeth, front teeth. which briefly stunned Bobby enough for him to take aim and fire the second shot. The bullet went right through Bobby's brain, splattering blood and brain tissue all over. It was a mess, a brutal murder scene.
The bloody murder of a six-year-old doesn't seem to shock Bonnie. Whatever instincts she has for children vanish with her first marriage. She wanted a family once, but her first husband doesn't.
She got pregnant not once or twice, but 11 times. And each of those 11 times, her husband forced her to have an abortion.
It is then Bonnie starts drinking.
It's too early for you to be drinking.
Yeah.
Perhaps to dull the pain.
And what have I got to live for?
Bonnie wanted children very badly, but had one abortion after another. And then eventually said she became to hate the idea of children. I'm guessing that was nothing more than a defense mechanism to help her deal with the fact that she had allowed herself to have 11 abortions.
Now, Bonnie's scarred psyche is under the control of Carl Hall.
One, two.
Cruelly, they string along the distraught parents.
They kept getting these ransom notes. So we kept thinking that, you know, he would come back safely at some point. And as it happened, of course, he didn't.
The Greenleases pay the ransom and wait for their son. He never shows. Bonnie and Carl go on the run with the ransom. Then one morning, Carl disappears.
Mister.
After Bonnie had served her purpose in the kidnapping, Carl dumps her. He leaves her drunk in a hotel room with a couple $1,000 and takes off.
Goes on a drunken spending spree that attracts police attention. Under pressure, he confesses everything and leads police back to Bonnie and a tiny grave under a flower bed in her backyard.
He was a very trusting child. That's exactly how Hetty described him afterwards. That he just took my hand. He was a very trusting child.
Both are convicted of murder. Bonnie Hetty and Carl Hall will die side by side in the gas chamber.
You know, they're strapped in and they're blindfolded. The very last words that they spoke was, Hetty says, Carl, I love you. And he said, I love you too.
What will make one woman kill another?
She's not a violent person. Never was. No history of violence.
Money?
She was in way too deep to get out of it.
Sex.
He wanted them to have sex with one another, Dawn and Susan.
Fear.
She was really, really worried about her son, that Fred was going to do something to the son.
Or all three.
The lives of two women were ruined because they could not stand up to this one evil man.
going down in upstate New York, in the town of Poughkeepsie.
I just want to show you, I made a cut back from here, and I've taken out a bit from there.
That's not what I'm interested in.
A developer
made
city approval for his water plans.
Take that.
But city representative Fred Andros
wants
something in return.
Do you want your permit or not? This will cover it all.
Fred was able to shake down companies very easily, and they would have to pay him off. If they didn't do what he said, Fred wouldn't give them the permits. They wouldn't be able to open their buildings. Simple as that.
Fred Andros has a strange power over people in business and in private. For the past 20 years, he's had an on-again, off-again affair with Dawn Silvernail.
I have no choice. I owe him a favor. You owe me a favor.
Now in her 50s, married with children, Dawn seems almost under his spell.
Okay.
For some reason, he was able to get women to trust him. And, you know, Dawn fell into that same category.
Crime writer M. William Phelps says from the time Dawn first met Fred, she could never really escape.
Dawn didn't really want to be romantic with Fred. She just no connection with him. So she takes off for this job down south, and she never told Fred where she was going. But she gets a call one day from Fred, and Fred says, "You can't hide from me. I know where you are at all times."
Over the years, Dawn has relied on Fred for money. In return, he or his associates receive sex.
Fred's power over Dawn didn't happen overnight. It happened over years. From the very first time Dawn was corrupted by him, she became his to do anything he wanted her to do.
Dawn isn't Fred's only plaything. He's also having an affair with Susan Fassett, a policeman's wife. Occasionally, he gets the two women together for his sexual gratification.
Get your robes off.
Fred decides that he wants Susan to have sex with another woman while he videotapes it. And Susan says, "Okay, I'll do it," because she wants to do anything to make Fred happy, I guess.
"Fred, I don't want to do this. I don't think I can do it."
"Get undressed."
I think Fred was able to control Susan and Dawn because they were afraid of him. After the very first time Susan had an intimate contact with Fred, he could use that against her in the future. She was married. She did have children. Dawn knew that he knew all the bad things she had done. I think they felt trapped.
Is also embroiled in Fred's shady shakedowns at the water department.
She picked up several envelopes of money while Fred was ongoing with his corruption scandal, which she went along with this and made some extra money by helping Fred out.
But Fred's corruption is about to be exposed. Captain Arthur Boyko from the Poughkeepsie Major Crime Unit was there.
He was under a corruption scandal and was a witness in a federal probe into his position as a town of Poughkeepsie water supervisor.
Yeah.
with the federal investigation looming, everyone is on edge.
Blueprint are okay, but there's something wrong with the specifications.
Well, look, I haven't done the permits. I haven't seen the
permits. Susan really decides she wants to distance herself.
I'll set up an appointment with him. I'll ring him back. Bye.
Take him back.
No, Fred. It's over.
He had told her about some of these things, so he kind of made it seem to her like you're involved as much as I am.
I love you, Susan.
Don't, not now.
And Fred could not take rejection. It was something he just couldn't take, so he turned rejection into revenge.
Be careful, Susan. Don't do anything you're gonna regret.
Fred is in deep trouble. Susan, a policeman's wife, can bring him down. He needs a fix. So he turns to his old girlfriend, ever reliable, Dawn Silvernail.
Fred says, well, I need you to do me a favor. That woman that you've been having sex with, that I've been videotaping, you need to kill her for me.
Silvernail has known Fred Andros for 20 years. He's been her friend, her lover, her financier.
What the hell?
Now he wants his return.
They look like surveillance photographs almost of Dawn's son, smoking a cigarette on the back dock where he works. There's a picture of Dawn's aunt walking her dog. And Fred says, you see these? You don't want anything to happen to these people, do you, Dawn?
Fred wants Dawn to be his assassin. The target is Susan Fassett, Fred's ex-lover, and Dawn's ex-sex partner.
Sure be a shame if there was a drive-by shooting and your son was shot.
She was in fear for her safety and well-being, as well as her family members. And that's what helped motivate her to do this crime.
It will be a cold-blooded execution. When Susan walks to her car after choir practice.
Fred was certainly the mastermind behind the whole thing. Provided Dawn with all the details where Susan would be. The time that she would be leaving the choir practice, and pretty much gave her everything she needed to commit the murder.
So Dawn parks right next to Susan's car, knowing that she's gonna come out at some point. And she just waited.
She was in the passenger side of her car. She had a ski mask on.
Had the gun in her hand, and she put the seat back in her car. So when Susan walked out, she wouldn't even see her. She keeps looking, and she sees Susan walk out of the church, walk across the street. Susan gets in her car, closes the door, and as Susan is putting her seatbelt on,
she sat up and pointed the gun out the window and fired and kept firing.
Dawn just kind of unloaded the gun. A lot of the bullets hit Susan Fassett.
Six shots don't kill Susan instantly. She will die 2 hours later in the hospital.
Susan was an innocent. She did nothing wrong except probably try to break up with the wrong guy.
Fred Andros is used to getting his way. But the weight of guilt will break Dawn's 20 years of subservience.
I can't do this.
What do you mean you can't do it?
She turns herself in.
Susan had family, two sons that loved her. And I think the emotional part of it eventually got to Dawn.
And there will be no deal when police arrive to arrest Fred.
Fred attempted to take his own life by shooting himself right underneath the chin, and the bullet exited between his eyes and then struck a wall right at the top of the stairwell where myself and one of the other investigators were standing.
Fred lives to be found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to 25 years. 2 years later, he dies of a heart attack. Dawn Silvernail is convicted of murder. She is currently serving a life sentence.
I think Dawn was only dangerous as long as Fred had something over her. And when that factor was removed from her life, she would have no reason to hurt anyone. She wasn't a criminal. He turned her into one.
Dawn's remorse continues to this day.
She says that there's not a night that goes by in prison that she doesn't have nightmares about this crime.
These deadly women became puppets, killing on demand. Dawn Silvernail hoped cold-blooded murder would cancel a debt. Bonnie Hetty's need for a man cut short a young life. And Jennifer Reale was conditioned to kill